I'm Patrick Weinman. Welcome to Past Lives. When we talk about slavery, we're talking about something hundreds of millions of people have experienced in hundreds of millions of different ways over the past 5,000 years. One of the first symbols ever recorded was on a clay tablet, written in the first language ever transcribed, Sumerian, and it translates to female slave of foreign origin. The Roman Empire consumed enslaved people like fuel, expending them in mines, quarries, and industrial bakeries. The Mamluk and Ottoman empires of the Muslim world rose to prominence on the backs and spilled blood of enslaved soldiers. Today's global economy is inextricable from past horrors of slavery, in particular the transatlantic slave trade that saw millions of African people stolen and shipped to South America, the Caribbean, and eventually the United States between the 16th and 19th centuries. So even at the very beginning of recorded history in Mesopotamia, slavery was there. And it hasn't gone away. From cobalt mines in the Congo to fast fashion sweatshops in Bangladesh to forced incarcerated labor in the United States, slavery is an active force in the lives of millions of people around the world today. That means that there is no way to make sense of our world without giving slavery far more attention than it's received in most accounts of the human past. But that fact, that slavery has been a feature of so many different societies and so many different times and places, can make it hard for us to grasp. Today on Past Lives, we're going to explore some big, broad perspectives on how to understand slavery as a concept, as a widespread historical fact, and as an ongoing scourge against humanity. What terms should we use? Can slavery be better or worse? Who counts as a slave, and how is it different from other forms of unfreedom? Can we even talk about slavery as a single thing? That's what we're going to find out. Slavery is protean. It takes an almost infinite variety of forms depending on when and where we're looking. In its most extreme manifestations, like the early modern Caribbean, more than half the populace might be enslaved and living under some of the most deliberately brutal conditions humans have ever experienced. In other settings, slavery has been more insidious and covert, restricted to particular segments of society, kept out of sight and conversation in the homes of the wealthy and the powerful. Slavery might be a lifelong condition, or it might be a new state, a violently inflicted deviation from a free person's prior state of being. Bondage could be temporary, and a great many formerly enslaved individuals lived out the end of their lives with some degree of freedom. Slaves might be chattel, a monetized form of property that could be transferred between owners without limit, or they might be tied to a specific parcel of land forever. They might have legal protections, they might not. In a few eras, enslaved people were marked by some fundamental difference from their enslavers. Race is the example we're most familiar with today. In far more places, however, there was no obvious visual distinction between free and unfree. In no time or place, whatever its peculiarities in that context, was slavery benevolent, beneficial to the enslaved, or in any way morally defensible. In the simplest terms, it has always been bad to be a slave, as it has always been bad to be a person who enslaves. But we're talking about thousands of years of formal laws and informal codes of behavior working together to disadvantage enslaved people in myriad ways, both large and small. Even for those lucky enough to be freed before their deaths, the stain of enslavement, the trauma, the horror, the grief, stayed with them to such a degree that it was often passed down to their descendants as well. The trope of the happy, contented slave, something we see everywhere from ancient Greek comedies to minstrel shows in the American South, never really reflected any kind of reality. The trope existed to make the masters and the average bystander feel better about themselves. If the slaves were happy with their lot in life, then how could the system that led to their enslavement be bad? How could anyone question it, especially when it made so many of them generationally wealthy? Not that masters, whether we're talking about Roman senators, Igbo slave traders in West Africa, or Mississippi planters, were all that concerned about the well-being of enslaved people. After all, these were bodies being used as a means to an end. This paternalistic ideal shows up in slaveholding societies time and again, a twisted concept of voluntary reciprocity within an entirely involuntary relationship. You've probably encountered this dichotomy before. I remember being given an assignment in high school to write an essay debating whether enslaved people in the American South were actually worse off than the wage slaves toiling in northern factories. Even the framing of the question reflects the warping effect of paternalism, because it implies that slave owners were incentivized to take better care of their quote-unquote property than factory owners were to take care of their wage employees. After all, the enslaved body was a commodity, and one wouldn't want a commodity to depreciate in value. The reality is that masters in all periods regularly brutalized the people they owned, regardless of their incentive to keep their property working productively, simply because they could. Beating a slave, whether for a perceived infraction or just because of the master's frustration, was played for laughs in those same minstrel shows and Greek comedies I mentioned earlier. This is the most basic misconception of slavery that we have to rectify here. It was never better to be enslaved than free, no matter how trusted, skilled, or even beloved an enslaved person might have been. At the end of the day, a benevolent master is still a master. This brings us to a point and a really thorny question. Were some varieties of slavery better than others? Many a scholar would say no, that even considering the question does a disservice to enslaved people. I'm really sympathetic to this point of view, and in many ways, I'm aligned with it. The idea that some manifestations of slavery might be better than others comes uncomfortably close to saying that not all manifestations of slavery were actually that bad. But that's fundamentally wrong. They were all bad. But, and this is a crucially important point, when we look at dozens of different instances of slavery spanning thousands of years and most of the planet, some were objectively worse than others. This has a lot to do with semantics. In this case, better and worse do not mean good and bad. To put it another way, if you've ever cared for someone with a terminal illness, you know that every possible path that leads to the end of that person's life is a bad one. There will be indignity, pain, and suffering because that's the nature of a terminal illness. But in a situation where every path is bad, it's also true that some paths are definitely worse. Nobody's going to pick the option that guarantees more unspeakable agony and more insults to your bodily autonomy. These variations all exist within a pretty narrow band, but the differences within that narrow band really matter. So it is with slavery. It was never good, but some manifestations of it were definitely worse than others. This nuance carries incredible significance in the abstract sense of how we understand slavery as a big picture phenomenon, a thing that has existed in so many different eras. We have to be able to compare slaveries, plural, not singular, across time and space. Otherwise, we'll never understand what was distinctive about slavery in a specific time and place, and what was typical. What facets of slavery defined it as an institution across time and place, and which were unique to the American South, say, or ancient Rome. It's important that we have a strong grasp of this comparative framework so that we in the present can understand how real people actually experienced slavery. Since past lives is all about those real people and how they experienced the world in their time, having this grasp is essential. Now, I'm not going to bog us down in the minutiae of academic scholarship on slavery or try to confuse you all with a bunch of technical terminology. For our purposes, it's enough to say that a lot of extraordinarily smart and dedicated scholars have spent their entire lives on the most granular aspects of this incredibly loaded and difficult subject. Their work is nuanced, invaluable, and constantly uncovering new aspects of how slavery functioned, how it shaped the lives of the people who experienced it, and how it impacted the world at large. I haven't read all of that scholarship. Nobody could, not even those who specialize in this topic. That's how deep this history goes and how much literature there is about it. But I have read broadly and closely, exactly as I would if I were teaching a course on slavery to advanced graduate students. The way I'm presenting today's episode and each of our 12 individuals over the course of this season is indebted to that work, and patrons will have access to a full bibliography on our Patreon. But there are still some concepts and ways of thinking about slavery that we can take directly from recent scholarship on the topic, and I want to introduce them to you. We just know so much more about slavery today than we did even a couple of decades ago. Its ubiquity, not just in Western societies, but around the world. How unusual a few aspects of the slaveries that we're most familiar with really are, and some criteria that we can use to get a handle on what slavery meant for the people who lived through it. This deep, specialized scholarship is what makes it possible for us to even begin to grasp the lived realities of slavery. So my favorite recent big think work on slavery is a book published by Cambridge University Press entitled What is a Slave Society? The Practice of Slavery in Global Perspective, edited by two really excellent scholars, Noah Lenski and Catherine M. Cameron. It includes contributions from more than a dozen historians, archaeologists, and anthropologists, and it surveys the history of slavery from ancient Greece to early modern Southeast Asia to America's Pacific Northwest region on the eve of European colonization. Lenski is a historian of the ancient Mediterranean. Cameron works on the American Southwest. Normally, these scholars of different times and places rarely intersect, no matter how similar their thematic interests are. That's just the nature of academia, where specialists are almost always siloed in separate departments at their respective schools. But that comparative perspective is vital, because it forces both the scholars writing the chapters and us reading them to consider what different systems of slavery have in common, and on what points they differ. That means coming up with criteria for comparison, ways in which we can place two or more slave societies side by side and make sense of how they operated. We have to be able to apply those criteria, not only to the best-known examples of slavery throughout history, but to all instances where unfreedom has been a part of the human experience. Unfortunately, that's a lot of cases. In the past, for decades, scholars made a straightforward division between societies with slaves and outright slave societies. Societies that happen to have slaves are those where the institution was marginal in terms of numbers and not essential to that society's overall economy. By contrast, slave societies were defined as having a substantial enslaved population, with the practice itself being absolutely central to the economic system, how society functioned, and even how slaveholders defined themselves for the world. In the very narrowest sense, only five societies in all of human history are considered true slave societies: ancient Greece and Rome, Brazil, the Caribbean, and the pre-Civil War American South. Historians have argued for a few more inclusions to this list, such as Rome's great rival Carthage and the Sokoto Caliphate of Central Sudan in the 19th century. Now, as operating paradigms go, the concept of a slave society has been pretty useful. The act of trying to decide whether a society counts as a slave society or not has helped us to analyze, compare, and dig deeper into how these slaveries actually functioned. But there is one major problem with the whole slave societies versus societies with slaves thing. It completely breaks down as we learn more about different instances of slavery across time and space. There is no stark distinction, no conspicuous crossable line on the way from a society that uses slave labor to being an outright slave society. What percentage of the population has to be enslaved for us to count it? Is it still a slave society if a large portion of the populace is enslaved, but some enslaved people also have wealth and occupy positions of authority? If enslaved people can't be bought or sold but make up a majority of the population, is that a slave society? Just how much of the total work in an economy do slaves have to do before we can say, yes, this is in fact a slave society? You might have guessed this, but there is no obvious answer to any of those questions. As a paradigm, the concept of a slave society has outlived its usefulness. We need a better organizing concept. I really like the alternative the historian Noah Lenski lays out in a chapter of that book I mentioned. Let's start with how he defines slavery. I think this is a pretty good working definition for our purposes here, and I'll quote it in its entirety before we break down what it means. Lenski says, quote, "Slavery is the enduring, violent domination of natally alienated and inherently dishonored individuals, slaves, that are controlled by owners, masters, who are permitted in their social context to use and enjoy, sell and exchange, and abuse and destroy them as property." So there are a few things here I want to clarify further. Natally alienated is a fancy way of saying that the enslaved person was excluded from the same rights that a person normally had when born into a given community. Family, clan, village, tribe, state, all of that was stripped away when a person was enslaved, what the famous sociologist Orlando Patterson called social death. Inherently dishonored just means that the condition of being enslaved was dishonorable in and of itself. Even if an enslaved person had access to wealth and power, like an Ottoman vizier or a trusted member of the Roman emperor's household, they were still a slave, a fact that made them lesser in the eyes of a free person. We can quibble with some aspects of Lenski's definition, especially around property, but it's broadly applicable to the myriad times and places we'll be discussing. When we're talking about a loaded subject as big as this one, Lenski's definition is as good as we're going to get in this short time. So how do we use that definition across cultures and eras? Lenski introduces the idea of intensity. Instead of a binary yes-no way of thinking about societies that had slavery, he argues that we should think in terms of a sliding scale focused on the answers to two distinct questions. How disadvantaged was the slave, and how dominant was the master? Under this scheme, the civilizations that we previously called slave societies would score really highly on a number of aspects of intensity. Let's take the pre-Civil War American South as an example. In that time and place, the condition of slavery was permanent. People had little hope of being freed. Extreme violence was a standard tool of domination and control from the slave ship to the grave. The very concept of race, invented by white people to uphold their own supposed supremacy, fully alienated enslaved people from any inborn rights and permanently dishonored them in the eyes of free people. Moreover, the disadvantages this system imposed on the enslaved populace doubled as advantages for their owners. Those disadvantages made the sale and valuation of enslaved bodies a frictionless process, streamlining it into becoming the foundation of the entire region's economic system. Along any axis of analysis we can imagine, the American South practiced an extraordinarily intense system of slavery. Now let's compare that to medieval serfdom in an average community in rural France in, let's say, the 12th century. Under our old definition, serfdom barely even counts as a society with slaves, let alone as a slave society. With intensity as our operating idea, however, we have everything we need to make a good solid comparison between serfdom in the American South. The condition of serfdom in medieval France was permanent, but serfs had far more autonomy in their daily lives than enslaved people in the American South. How they worked, how they accumulated and expended resources, and most of all, the rights, limited but still valuable, that defined their position. They weren't bought and sold as chattel, for example, and couldn't be easily removed from land they and their ancestors had worked for generations. Having a large number of serfs tied to a parcel of land might increase the value of that land, but the serfs themselves were not monetizable property. Serfs were constantly running away and engaging in small acts of everyday resistance to frustrate their lords. Lords thought they were just being lazy and useless rather than avoiding work that didn't benefit them in any way. To remedy that, medieval aristocrats, generally speaking, had far fewer tools for imposing violent discipline on their serfs than southern slave owners did for their slaves. So while none of that is good in any way, it's clear that as a system, medieval serfdom was a far less intense form of domination than slavery in the American South. And if our mental model of slavery is the American South, which is a pretty reasonable expectation given its prevalence in school curricula, pop culture, and the cultural background of most people listening to this show, we're going to be led astray. There was no middle passage in ancient Rome. The medieval Islamic world, where enslaved people filled armies and wealthy households, didn't have a fully developed concept of race tied into its institutions of slavery. There were no plantations with hundreds of enslaved workers in early modern Venice. But slavery was still central to those societies, which means we have to be able to understand what it actually meant to the people who lived in those times and places. Now that we have this framework in mind, we have all the tools we need to start digging into the lives of some of the hundreds of millions of real people who experienced slavery over the past 3,000 years. Our first stop will be Iron Age Assyria, where a woman named Nanaya Ilai and her daughter, whose name has been lost to time, were ripped from their home in a violent campaign of conquest, forcibly marched for hundreds of miles, and sold to strangers in a city where they didn't know a single soul. We'll explore the dynamics of ancient empires and how slavery oiled the mechanisms that made their societies run smoothly, and what that meant for people like Nanaya Ilai and her daughter. Make sure you subscribe to this feed and click the link in the episode description to head over to the Past Lives Patreon. It's only $7 a month. We already have tons of bonus content, like interviews with great historians about their favorite historical figures, and we're adding more every week. Our Patreon is also where you'll find our Past Lives chat, where you can talk about history with other interested folks. I'll even drop in from time to time. We'll have a weekly discussion thread, and the first one is about the best history books you've ever read. If you're a patron, you'll get to vote on what we read for our monthly Past Lives book club. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. Sound design and music by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Thanks so much for joining me today. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.